might say the meanest things. Sometimes we're not much company. There's no rearranging, our writing remains the same. We remain the same. And as far as we're concerned, you belong to us. Pop Dose.
Hi everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Pop Dose Podcast. I'm Dave Lifton, and we put the band back together. That's right. Joining me today are Jeff Giles, of course, no stranger to our podcasting empire here at Poptos, and after an absence of about a year and a half, the prodigal son returns, ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, Jason Hare. Gentlemen!
I just applauded for myself.
Somebody's got to do it.
What's up, fuckers?
Who are you guys?
I know. Did you say how or who?
Who are you guys?
Yeah, so much has happened since the three of us were last together. Two of us have become homeowners, and one of us has become a father. And...
Soon to be three.
Uh-oh.
Soon to be three. I just our offer was just accepted on a house out in Billy Joel's hometown of Hicksville, New York.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah.
I knew you were looking at homes because my wife follows your wife on Pinterest.
Oh, God.
Yep.
Oh, God.
And just last night she said, Jessica likes all the same rugs that I like. I said, great. You guys can shop for rugs together and leave me out of it.
We've been, Dave, you're getting older up there. You must be looking for a rug soon, too.
Not me. I got my mom's jeans in that department.
Along with the breasts.
The boobs.
The fabulous rack.
We've been looking for a house for since way back, maybe even when Jessica first got pregnant, or maybe even before she got pregnant. But, we put things on hold, and we've been looking for a long time. We saw a house literally, I think, a week ago. And while we were reviewing it, I think five offers came in or something like that.
Good God.
We jumped on it. So we'll see what happens. We've got they accepted our offer. We've got the inspection tomorrow, and I suddenly feel incredibly old.
You should. Yeah. And you also should have shopped for a house out here where a house will stay on the market for a year, a year and a half. Price keeps going down.
Yeah, the commute to Soho is a bitch, though, is the problem.
Why? It's only... half an hour flight to from Manchester to LaGuardia.
Right, seems affordable.
Yeah,
seems affordable.
You can get a travel expense, right?
I could try. I could certainly try.
Aren't you an executive VP at your job yet?
I am not. I'm not. I would come there, live near from you, but you disowned me since I took my job and stopped writing.
I didn't disown. I could never do that, baby.
That's what you always say.
I mean it every time.
Yeah. It was just about this time last year. You stopped by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in Brooklyn for a conference.
Because
I'm powerful.
You are powerful.
I was moderating a panel at a conference.
It was a kindy conference.
It was. It was all about kids' music.
Oh yeah, I remember when you did that.
Yeah, that was back when I was still running Pop Dose's sibling site, Dad Nabbit, before I fired myself.
And let go to hell under the ownership of Dan Walsh.
I did, yeah. Dan Walsh is steering the ship now. I'm no longer doing that, and I will not be at KindyFest this year. So sadly, I will not be able to make a 1 year checkup with little Ella Bean.
Aww,
that's too bad. I liked it. I liked that when you do. You remember when you came? You showed up at the door, and I just handed her to you, and just closed the door. And...
Fatherhood.
She was at a volatile stage at that point, but.
And now she's climbing furniture. I just saw on Facebook. You are in a world of hurt. She's ambulatory and all bets are off.
I know. She's still not walking, and I don't know why I'm in such a rush for that to happen.
Yeah, but, you're not. You're really not. Change your mind about that.
I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know why I'm so like, I'm like, come on, walk. Come on, walk.
But be glad that you didn't have a son because, when all kids, when they start to move, they will... They'll put you through hell, but a son is a special flavor of hell. This afternoon, my son punched himself in the face with an egg.
Wait, he what? He punched himself with an egg?
Twice.
With a hard-boiled egg, I'm assuming.
Yeah, yeah, he punched himself. No, actually, it wasn't hard-boiled.
Oh, God.
Punched himself in the mouth with an egg.
With a raw egg?
Yeah. I should explain.
Please.
I think we're good.
I think you probably saw it on Lifehacker, too. How to make a hard-boiled scrambled egg.
I hadn't seen that. Okay.
So what you do is you put it in a shirt sleeve. And you take a couple of rubber bands to pinch the egg in, and then you take the sleeve and you use like a jump rope, right? So you wind up the sleeve and then you pull it taut, uh-huh. So it spins the egg. And you do that over and over again, and it's supposed to scramble the egg inside. And he wanted to do that, so I let him, but his arms aren't very long. And so as he was spinning the egg in the shirt sleeve, he punched himself in the mouth. But he wanted to do it again, so I let him, and then he punched himself in the mouth again with a different egg. So that's my son.
Look, obviously you wouldn't trade your kids for anything.
You're right.
But that said, then do you think it's better to have two girls? Because that doesn't seem better to me.
Oh no, I don't think so. I don't know. I always go back to what Louis C.K. said about daughters and sons. I think you are familiar with this routine, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think about it all the time.
It's true. In my experience, it's absolutely true. I think, Dave, you probably know this joke too, don't you?
I'm sure I've heard it.
About how all kids will inflict terrible damage on their parents, but daughters, they will destroy you inside.
Yes.
They will kill your soul, but right. a son, yeah.
Right. Boys will fuck shit up, and girls will fuck you up.
Right, exactly.
Right. Like he talks about his nephew or something coming in and pouring sand in his sister's drink or something.
Yep.
Right. But his daughter comes up to him and says, "She broke my Barbie. Now break hers." And he did it.
The other day, Sophie was upset with Owen for doing something. I can't remember what it was, but she told Leah that every time he did it, she should remove a tooth. And she was serious. She was dead serious. So
that's
there you
beautiful.
Go. It's all true. Everything
that's
Louis
pretty
true.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And how have you been, Dave? Here, Jeff and I are just talking about our own shit,
like parents do on social media all the time. God.
I'm okay, thanks. Just been real busy working. I was just in Florida for a few days. My whole family got together for the first time since...
Yeah, I saw those photos.
Yeah, Thanksgiving 2010 was the last time we were all together.
Everybody's sitting around looking at their screens. That was great.
Yeah, well, that was... last time we were all together, my sister took a picture of me and my nephews and nieces all doing this, all sitting on the couch and chairs, like, in a row... staring at our devices.
Yep.
So I saw that my two sisters and my brother-in-law were doing the same thing, and I'm like, oh, I've got to, you know, post the second part of that. It was just a callback to that.
When I show up late at your mother's apartment, I find her staring at her devices.
I thought of you guys yesterday. My dad's jokes have gotten a little bit more... a little bit less subtle, and I know they weren't subtle. But I thought you guys were just like this joke. Like we were sitting around
like
we were at my aunt's
house. Like he was the subtlest comic in Long Island before that.
But some of his jokes are actually quite clever. This one wasn't though. We were sitting around the table. We were at my aunt's house, and one of my younger relatives, she's like 13, was walking around with Ella and just kind of watching her. And her mom said to me, "Oh, don't worry about it at all. She loves little kids." And my dad goes, "Yeah, you know who else loves little kids? Priests."
The Pope, am I right?
It was just like the way he delivered it. He thought like nobody had any idea what the punchline was going to be.
I have to say, I'm very sad that this house that you bought is not next door to your parents.
I bet you are. You know, I have to be honest.
You were talking about that, weren't you, at one point?
Well, I was. I would say to Jessica, you know, if the people next door move out and we still don't have anything, maybe we should just do it. And I think they might be moving out in June. I think if it had gotten to that point, I was interested to see what would have happened.
Me too.
Yeah, right. I bet. But no, I'm not. I won't be next door. But I'll be. He's really good with that. He's really good with Ella. Adores him.
They're probably right on the same wavelength.
Right. Well, they both crap their pants. By the way, it's so great that we're back together, all of us, at this specific time of year.
Because it's Easter.
Well, because you know what tomorrow is.
Jew's revenge.
Tomorrow, Easter is... candy half off.
That's right. Barco
Jew's Oh, that
I
makes
love
me laugh.
Bruce
Every time I think of that, it makes me laugh. Barco Jew's. I was just thinking how perfect it was that it's Easter and two Jews and an atheist are having a podcast. It's great.
Well, I'm an atheist too. I'm just a cultural Jew.
I'm not even that.
What?
I mean, technically we got together last night for quote unquote Passover.
Which was the Seders were earlier in the week though.
But there was matzah on the table.
Did you guys see that Daily Show clip where Obama was in Israel?
Yeah.
Said, I did not.
This is good matzah. No, nobody says that.
That's good matzah.
But yeah, no, it's true. I've been waiting for it. After I finish my editing shift tomorrow, I will go down to Target and load up. And I will take a picture of it and Instagram it.
I got like no Easter candy this year. We bought some M&Ms with pretzels in them, and I've almost finished the bag.
Oh, I'm sorry, honey.
Yeah, it's...
That's right, you do like M&Ms.
I eat a lot of chocolate these days.
I remember when you had that office gig at the hospital, I would threaten to send you pounds of M&Ms, and you would cry about how it was going to make you fat.
You threatened to send me a lot of things when I had that job.
Often I did send you those things.
That's true.
I never sent the M&Ms, true. Though.
No, instead you sent the Benny Mardonis.
Benny Mardonis. However, we should talk about the last thing I sent you, which was awesome.
Oh, boy.
A baby?
What was the last thing you sent me?
I sent it to your parents' house, and you were afraid to open it, even though I told you.
That's right. That's right. The autographed photo of the cast of Family Ties.
Including Brian Bonsall. Right?
Including Brian Bonsall. You ever thought he was going to be the one that went off the deep end, right?
Yeah. None of which is what we're here to talk about.
That's right.
That's right.
We have
good
digressed
segue.
And digressed and digressed again.
Okay. Right. That's right. There is a reason why we are all, why we have, as I said, brought the band back together. And under normal circumstances, having the three of us together again would be cause for celebration. Unfortunately, it was a sad event that brought us back on March 30th. Which is the day before we have recorded this, we lost a man whose career has been very important in our lives, and that was producer Phil Ramone, who passed away at the age of 72. So we wanted to take some time out to talk about his work and how it influenced us. I feel safe in saying that for all three of us, our introduction to Phil Ramone came through his 10-year association with Billy Joel.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Jason, yeah. You want to start off with that, Jason?
Yeah, that's pretty. I mean, well, it's funny because I think, you know, we've been discussing this on our Popdos mailing list, and I think there have been a lot of reactions from people where they're like, "I didn't even remember that, or I didn't even know that Phil Ramone had a hand in this project or that project." So I was listening to things that Phil Ramone did probably a good amount of time before I knew him from Billy Joel's work. So, like, for example, he produced Pippin.
Really?
Yeah. He produced the sound. He produced the I mean, that's an album.
The OCR, yeah.
The Broadway musical. He produced Pippin. That is an album that I listened to nonstop before I went back into the closet. back out of the closet.
Give us the chorus of Corner of the Sky right now.
I used to audition with that song.
I remember the Jackson 5 did it.
He also was an associate producer on Afternoon Delight.
Oh, God.
Oh.
Son of a bitch. It always goes back to those guys.
I said, just quick digression. I sent my dad a YouTube video of Starland Vocal Band. I fell down the Starland Vocal Band YouTube rabbit hole.
I saw that on Facebook.
I sent him this video, and he said, that brings back so many memories. He says, I still remember seeing them my freshman year in college in 1965. I didn't have the heart to tell him that they formed in 1976. just couldn't help it. But
I was thinking of your dad and Starland Vocal Band the other day or last week because I saw Emmylou Harris and Ronnie Crowell was wondering if they were going to do Boulder to Birmingham.
Boulder to Birmingham.
But they didn't. So
great song. Oh, well. But my real introduction to him was through The Stranger, which was like the first Billy Joel album. I can't remember if that or Innocent Man was the first one I ever heard, but Stranger was the first one that I really played from start to finish.
Right. Well, Stranger you didn't hear when it first came out.
No. I believe I got into it.
It was playing in the delivery room.
Because, you know, I had heard at the time when I started getting into music, Billy Joel was popular because of Uptown Girl and whatnot. And so my cousin gave me a copy of The Stranger. And that is just such a, I mean, it's just such a, it seems so cliche to say it, but it's such a great album. I mean, it's the first really solid Billy Joel album because it's the first album that took his strengths as a live performer and put it in the studio, recreated it in the studio. And I think a lot of that is down to Phil Ramone. I mean, it was clear Absolutely. That Billy Joel wasn't going to work with anybody at that point who wasn't going to let him use his own band. I think he even turned down George Martin to produce The Stranger because George Martin wanted to use session musicians. So I mean,
under what pretense did your cousin give you The Stranger? Was it like, oh, Innocent Man is shit, you have to hear this?
I don't remember what it was. It might have been that, you know, I think I was 6 or so at the time.
Wow.
And I think I probably was just going through his record collection, and he made a copy of that. He made a copy of a bunch of, he gave me that. He gave me H2O. Okay. Hall & Oates.
I love the idea of a 6-year-old listening to The Stranger.
It was great.
Well, I was 8.
I think I was probably around 8, but I just mean, like, at that age you can't really wrap your head around a lot of what he's talking about on that record.
Oh, absolutely not. But that's like, so you know, we have this all the time. Your lyrics, I'm music, right? So for me being 6 and hearing Scenes from an Italian Restaurant, the power behind that track and the journey, you know, was really inspiring for me. And I think it was, you know, a lot of that was Phil Ramone's work and, you know, making sure that band did that song from start to finish, you know, that it wasn't like they did the first section and then did the second section at a different point in time. I mean, it has that kind of feel to it.
Right.
Those are, I mean, my favorite albums are always the ones that sound like they were cut live in the studio. I mean, he was essentially the additional member to that band.
Which is what Billy said in his statement.
The most talented member, right?
Oh,
the most
he?
Talented member. Yeah. I always thought of Phil Ramone as the most talented guy in my band. So much of my music was shaped by him and brought to fruition by him. I have lost a dear friend and my greatest mentor.
Yeah, but you know he said that just to piss off Liberty DeVito.
Right. Well, I think it's funny that he says he always thought of Phil Ramone as the most talented guy in his band, and yet he was the first one to be fired. When he replaced him with Mick Jones.
Nice.
For Jeff's favorite Billy Joel album, Stormfront.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is that thing. I didn't know at the time. Yeah, the first album I got, as I said, was The Stranger. And I remember hearing at the time on the radio Priests condemning Only the Good Die Young.
That's what made it a hit, right?
Yeah. You know, I didn't know at the time that he also produced Still Crazy After All These Years, because I remember knowing 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover when it was new. and that was a couple of years before that. But Phil, but that was the first record where I saw the words, you know, produced by Phil Ramone. And with me, like, growing up, my attitude, and I guess it's still kind of like this, anything that was my favorite was inherently the best, you know? Like, the Yankees were my favorite baseball team, so every player on the Yankees was the best in the league in that position, right? So, like, because Billy Joel was my favorite, that meant that Phil Ramone was the best producer. So when I would see something that was produced by him, I automatically knew it was a good album.
Yeah, I felt the same way.
Yeah. And it turns out with Ramone, I was right. I was thinking about it yesterday. There are, like, there's George Martin and there's Phil Ramone. And then there's, like, everybody else. Because you think of so many well-known producers, and it could be Phil Spector, John Bryan, Timbaland, Brian Eno, anybody, who have, like, signature sounds or things that they do that call attention to the producers. And Ramone didn't have that.
No, he was invisible.
No, you don't hear, you just hear the music, but how you're hearing it was entirely shaped by him.
Yep. Mm.
And like Jason said, you get the feeling that, you know, because everything is in such a certain place, especially when you're listening to it with headphones, everything is in such a place that you can hear every instrument clearly, no matter how many instruments there are in a song. There's no clutter, and you get the sense that they're all in this room playing live, even if that wasn't always the case, even if it was, you know, at least, you know, recording the rhythm section live and then building onto that.
Yeah, he walked a really fine line between making his stuff super clean and making it sound live. You know, he didn't go too far in either direction.
Yeah, and also you think of, like, some of the producers who have, like, immaculate recordings as he did, and they just sound like the life has been choked out of them. They're just so cold.
Yep.
I guess, you know, like Steely Dan's Gaucho is probably the most famous example of that.
Yeah. You know, it's easy to have a record go from clean to bloodless. And I think even with the bridge, he didn't really cross that line. Even as many synths as there are on that record, mm-hmm. it sounds better than Stormfront.
And it's clear, you know, in the studio that he had, you know, Billy Joel being somebody that generally didn't take a lot of, well, as he used to say, he didn't take any shit from anybody, right? But it was clear that he valued Phil Ramone from the start as a contributor to the arrangements. You know, it was his idea to take Just the Way You Are and change the rhythm of that song, you know, that I think he called it like a backwards samba or something like that.
Yeah, I think so.
It was, you know, his
idea. It had a different rhythm. He changed it around a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, to give it something a little bit different, to just not make it, you know, just pure Muzak. Or anything, you know, there are other things that are so recognizable from that album. You know, the Stranger Whistle was his idea. You know, things like that. The ack in Moving Out, that was him. Like, he didn't, I mean, it's just cool that he was able to, that he had that kind of influence. I've been working too hard to give you a heart attack, ack, 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 ack. You wanna know by now. Who needs a house out in Hackensack?
Is that all you get for your money? Actually, I did some, called up a friend of ours today to get his take on Phil Ramone.
Could it be Pete Lubin?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, Pete Lubin.
Yeah, I emailed him. I said, "Hey, we're doing this thing on we're doing a podcast about Phil Ramone. Do you have any? You know, I figured you guys had to have crossed paths at some point." And he's like, "Oh boy, did we!" So I spoke to him for about 20 minutes. I called him up. And we talked.
Only 20 minutes?
Yeah. I love that. He said,
That's not a slight, by the way, against Pete. I just think Pete's got
a million
beautiful stories.
Yeah. Right,
that
yeah.
could go on for hours.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
I'm sorry, but go ahead.
That's totally true. Pete worked, he was working, he had brought a guy named Martin Briley to Mercury. Yeah, The Salt in My Tears.
Yep.
Yeah,
sure.
That was his signing. And for the third album, the follow-up to that, they had a little bit of traction, they had a little bit more of a budget, and they decided to go all out and hire Phil Ramone. It was his call, and he's like, "Well, I really, really, really want to work with Phil Ramone." And it did not go well. Now, keep in mind that I'm doing a lot of paraphrasing here because remember how Seth, and I told him this, I said, remember how we were worried about what would happen to his reputation if we let him slam Bob Lefsetz? basically what happened was Ramon, in addition to commanding a huge fee, also when you work with Phil Ramon, that also means triple scale session guys.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the credits for the album, it's got G.E. Smith and Anton Figg and Dave LeBolt. And on top of that, Ramon had other priorities at the time.
I think he was working on this story, actually.
Okay, the White Knight soundtrack and Julian Lennon. So it didn't really go well. But he did say, and he also took a lot of time in saying this, talked about Ramon as a person, and he saw why Ramon was so successful and so loved, was that when he was there and he was able to devote his time, if Pete had a problem with it, he said his bedside manner was incredible. You know, he would start talking, you know, he would go to Phil and start talking and say, yeah, you know, this is my thing. And then the stories would start coming out. And he would reach down into the refrigerator, pull out some vodka and a couple of glasses, and, you know, they'd just start drinking and telling stories. And he'd be telling all these stories about everybody that he's worked with all night long. And just that, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, one day Joe Esposito comes into the studio, who's a member of the Memphis Mafia, and starts telling Elvis stories. You know, so it was like he had a way of welcoming you into it and had such incredible personal charm that, you know, even though, you know, this project didn't go very well, you know, he still liked him as a person. So that's a firsthand account.
That's great. Dangerous moments, dangerous times to be alone. Dangerous moments,
dangerous times to be so far from home. But yeah, in reading about him yesterday, I learned that I didn't know that he was a child prodigy on violin and piano, trained at Juilliard, and that he apprenticed at the Brill Building and opened his studio when he was 17 or 18. You know, so there are some producers who are musicians and others who are more technical, but he had a hand in both
camps.
He
was both, yeah.
Yeah.
I was surprised to hear that he engineered the Stan Getz Zhao Gilberto album.
That's the song. I was hoping that Jason was going to say his parents would sing The Girl from Ipanema to each other. Like his dad was playing nylon string guitar over in the corner while his mom was making dinner. Alas.
And well, no, it was not to be.
Yeah. Well, I was listening to that yesterday, and it's just, you know, like you hear the air in his saxophone during his solo, and it's just so sexy. And unfortunately, at the time, I was on the bus.
So,
but you masturbated anyway.
It's not the same as like when you're listening to it during a romantic dinner. Unfortunately, there were enough other crazy people masturbating on the bus.
What's your favorite Phil Ramone record?
Well, mine would obviously have to be The Stranger. I mean, that would be. I mean, what's my favorite Phil Ramone record would be like, you know, All My Life.
You know, fucking liar.
Right. The work. Well, obviously, it would be Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta's Christmas album. That would be the one.
Son of a
bitch. I mean, when you say record, do you mean whole record, or do you mean like?
Yeah. I mean, album.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for me, it would be The Stranger. How about you? Well, I bet I know what your answer is.
What do you think my answer is?
I think Jeff has the same one as mine.
Okay. Well, let's hear it, guys. What do you think it is?
Still Crazy After All These Years.
It's actually the one before that.
There Goes Raymond Simon?
Yeah.
Because it has your favorite song on it. It has your favorite Paul Simon song on it. I was listening to that album today.
It has It has a few of my favorite Paul Simon songs, but it's also the reason I asked that question. It was when you were talking about hearing the air in the sax. There's a lot of air in that record. You know, it sounds like people in a room. And as much fondness as I have for The Stranger, I think that record, I don't know, there's just something about There Goes Rhyme and Simon. Hold up, hold. Say with regards to The Stranger, I think we should talk about the back cover, because
absolutely
that was another thing, him wearing a Yankee jersey, it was, and, you know, like,
well,
the
him being on it,
like,
being
thing.
On it, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think that, yeah. There, I was thinking about this today, and I think that picture and the way it kind of, it made me think of rock, it made me think of art as something that you could do. Like that whole Band of Brothers vibe, you know, it was something absolutely. That you did with your buddies. And I think I've held on to that for a long time. I think that maybe that even informed why I wanted to do Pop-Dos, you know, just the idea that creating is more fun when you do it together. And there's just something about,
as Jason learned a year and 9 months ago.
There's just something about that picture. I mean, it's a simple photograph, and there's nothing that's explicit about it, but it's you can tell that these are guys who like each other, and that they're the ones who made this music, and it isn't just Billy Joel, it's Billy and these other guys.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
And the producer is just as important to that record as anybody else. I mean, who else would do that?
Right.
Who else would, or what other producer gets put on the picture as a band member?
Yeah,
right. It just looked like, and it looks like it was taken after the session. They all went out to an Italian restaurant,
yeah.
Had a few drinks, and said, somebody said, "Hey, let's take our picture." Just like we all do whenever we're together with friends nowadays. We have the waitress take our picture with our cell phones or something.
Yeah, that photo had a lot to do with why I liked his music as a kid.
And that's the picture that Liberty DeVito used in his statement on Facebook.
When he said, his legal statement when he was suing Billy for royalties.
No, and he said, "What can I say about a man who was brave enough to put his reputation on the line with a bunch of unknowns and turn us into what we became? We loved him. We called him Uncle Phil. I lost contact with him, and I know he was looking for me at the NAMM shows. I regret not finding him. It's too late to tell him thanks for making me the musician that I am today. You are my greatest teacher. I can't stop crying because I can't believe that you're gone."
So many spelling errors.
I know.
Sorry. He's a drummer. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm so disrespectful.
In our old familiar place, you and I, face to face.
In the last 20 years of his life, he worked mostly on these high-profile crossover records, you know, like the duets albums by Tony Bennett and Ray Charles.
Yeah.
You know? I stayed away from those because I always prefer to listen to the originals. But you'd still see the ads for them. And it would be, and it would always, like, say in big letters, you know, produced by Phil Ramone. And you just think, of course, who else would they get? You know, you've got these legendary names. You know, you've got to have a producer who can rise to the occasion. Had you guys heard any of those, and were they any good, at least from a technical standpoint, or were they just kind of like syrupy and kind of a?
I think it was around that time that Phil kind of lost the plot in terms of his method. You know, He became really infatuated with having musicians record in separate studios. I think he was one of the guys behind
Sinatra's.
Sinatra, yeah,
definitely behind that. But there was a label. What was it? N2K. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Mm-mm.
No.
He was. I don't remember if he was one of the owners or if he was a house producer, but it was one of these. It was a label that was started, I think, around the turn of the century, and was geared toward
Encoded, N2K Encoded. Yeah, it was founded by Grusin and Rosen, the GRP guys.
Anyway, that was when he really got into doing stuff via fiber optics and stuff like that, and away from putting people in a room. And I know that was the way that the Sinatra stuff was recorded. You know, nobody was together.
Yeah.
I don't know if the backing tracks were recorded that way, but it was a few steps removed from the stuff that I loved when I found out who he was.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I imagine at the time, you know, in 93 or whenever the Duets album was, that was considered a really amazing thing, and it was an amazing thing. But ultimately it certainly takes away a lot.
So, to answer your question, no, I never listened to any of the Duets records. I think I did listen to Genius Loves Company when it came out, but I haven't listened to it since then.
That was that's the Ray Charles one?
Yeah.
Sorry. I listened to that once, I think.
I remember, I think it was 91, and I was browsing the single section at my local music emporium. And
As I did.
And there was a guy named Russ Irwin, who I think now is the touring keyboard player for Aerosmith. And at the time, he was new signing at SBK, which was a big deal because SBK was flush with Wilson Phillips money.
Wilson Phillips money, yeah.
Yeah, and they got Phil Ramone to produce his first record, and I checked it out for that reason.
And?
That was awful. It was awful. It was adult contemporary piano ballad stuff. He did a song, I bet you can find it on YouTube if you want to. It's called My Heart Belongs to You. That was his big first single. And it makes Air Supply sound muscular.
Number 28. It went to 28 on Billboard. That's what it says.
On the pop charts?
On Billboard Hot 100.
Wow.
What year was this, 91?
91 or 92, yeah, I can't remember. I think it was 91.
Huh.
Anyway, when I think of Phil Ramone, I also think of buying music just because I saw his name attached, and
sure,
right,
didn't always work out very well, but yeah. Usually it did.
It's funny. I was talking with my cousin about this yesterday because I sent him the news, and he's like, "Yeah, I loved everything he did except like the Julian Lennon album had too much Yamaha DX7 on it."
Well, what didn't?
That was my answer too. I'm like, didn't you have one?
Right. I mean, it was like what? It was 1986?
84. 84.
Oh, 84. Yeah. Sure. So you, Dave, you didn't get a chance to talk about your favorite.
Well, mine is still crazy after all these years.
Is that the most New York album of all New York albums ever made?
It's got to be up there. Yeah.
It's practically Rhapsody in Blue.
Maybe like a Beastie Boys record or something right. Like that. If you want to like say that, like the mid 70s was such a, between Woody Allen and Paul Simon,
yeah.
You know, like the idea of Upper West Side, New York Jewish angst being in the height of popular culture. Yeah. That's definitely up there. I mean, and then Paul Simon, of course, was in Annie Hall. Really? They give out awards for that stuff? I thought just earplugs.
Did you see there was a super? I saw a supercut of.
I didn't watch
all every of, stammer,
all of stammer, all of Woody Allen stammers. Yeah. It's 45 minutes long.
It sounded way too painful. I did not watch it.
I started at the beginning. I got 2 minutes in, and I moved to like minute 36, and then I got to about 43 minutes, and Jessica's like, "Turn that off." She's dying. But anyway.
Yeah, but yeah, no, that you're totally right about that. You know, but you think of how many incredible songs are on there, not just the title cut. Have a Good Time, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, or my own personal version of that, 50 Ways to Love Your Lever.
To love your lifting. To leave your lifting.
you know, you just think of like the Steve Gadd two drumsticks in each hand rhythm, if you've ever seen, you know. In the,
yeah, speaking in the, of Gad, I mean, it's the guys who played on that record. That's the cherry on the sundae in terms of New Yorkness on that record. The whole New York studio mafia was on that album.
Speaking of which, we lost a guy the other day.
Yep.
Who was on both Still Crazy After All These Years and The Stranger, and it was Hugh McCracken. So I have to confess that yesterday I was writing a piece, an obit about Ramon, and I went to put it in there that, you know, coincidentally, Hugh McCracken, who worked on The Stranger, and, you know, also died, you know, to link back to that piece about that. And I swear to God, I almost wrote Phil McCracken.
I think you're getting him confused with Phil McCrevis.
Yeah. And Pat McCroy.
Phil McCrevis and Pat McCroy. They were kind of like the Everly Brothers, but their material was a little more scatological. They had a hard time getting on the radio. They worked right. Blue.
Westboro Baptist is protesting outside their concerts.
God hates McCroy.
I know he hates mine. He's not getting any use.
I met my old lover on the street last night. She seemed so glad to see me. I just smiled. And we talked about some old times. And we drank ourselves some beers. Still crazy after all these years. Oh, still crazy after all these years.
You know, I read somewhere that he wanted that band to work so tightly together that in the studio he used to make Doug Stegmeier sit right next to Billy Joel's left hand to see where he was, what he was doing, because Billy Joel's left hand, like Dave's, is so strong, but you know, he's doing so much in the bass there at the bottom end of the piano that he used to make Doug sit right next to his left elbow and watch him play so that he knew where to go.
Right.
He made Richie Cannata sit just because. He made him sit in the corner, even if he wasn't on the song, he had to sit.
It seems like in his later years, I mean, he was really just working with legacy artists.
Right.
I'm looking at his discography on his webpage. One of his last projects was a George Michael album. Actually, he did a couple of George Michael albums.
I think
which was all legacy stuff. It was like his George Michael's Songs from the Last Century album, which even I haven't listened to.
Didn't he work on some George Michael stuff that hasn't come out yet?
I believe so. Yeah. So George Michael had a tour doing some, you know, some symphonic versions of his songs. Imagining the symphony version of like I want your sex.
No,
don't imagine that.
Sting did it first. If you can say that Sting did it first, you probably shouldn't do it. So put the lute down, George.
Did Phil Ramone produce Symphonicities?
I don't think so.
Probably Hugh Padgham.
Yeah. But I guess that goes back to like what they were talking about, him being a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he saw that there was raw talent there in that band, but, you know, they didn't really know how to record it. And maybe that's kind of weird because, like, I think of, like, the concerts, the bootleg that I have of the 1976 show at the Bottom Line, and mm-hmm. they're pretty damn tight as it is.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what it is. I mean, anything before The Stranger doesn't sound. I don't know if feel free to disagree, but none of that stuff I think has anything similar to the energy of anything after.
Yeah, energy is the key there. Mm-hmm. And he was, like we said at the beginning, it's because he was invisible. I mean, he knew how to capture the sound of a band without turning it into a religion. You know, he wasn't Rick Rubin. He didn't, you know, it wasn't like three takes and you're done and these are the warts and all. And you know, this is the I don't know how else to put it, but the stuff was complicated, and it was tight, and there were obviously overdubs, but underneath it all, there was heat, there was energy, there was warmth.
I think he also managed to respect, you know, whatever vibe the band was going for, because the Nylon Curtain doesn't sound anything like The Stranger.
But he was also a guy who knew how to navigate the technology of the 80s without crawling up his own ass.
That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, because his mindset was to be invisible and to not put his own stamp as a producer on this.
Right.
Sure. I guess that this comes from the fact that his time as an engineer came on so many of those jazz records in the 60s. You know, it got him to understand about the room and atmospherics, because you think of like those post-bop records, like what Rudy Van Gelder was doing in his home in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, you know, that came out on Blue Note. You know, these things, they still sound so perfect, and everything is, you know, like those Ramon productions, everything is like in its place, and there's so much space for everybody to work and shine, and yet there's a warmth there that's remarkable.
Well, he never threw out the rhythm section either.
Right.
Unlike, say, David Foster. You know, even a I think The Bridge is a pretty cold sounding record, but it has live drums and a live bass, and that makes a big difference. Mm-hmm.
I listened to The Bridge a while ago.
I'm sorry.
For the first time in years. There are a couple of songs that I don't really like.
This is the
like
time.
Big Man on Mulberry Street.
Oh, I like that song, but This Is the Time. I can't tolerate that song.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but what really stood out for me was Code of Silence.
That's a good song.
It's a great
and
song.
And Getting Closer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Getting Closer is great.
It ends really well, I think.
Actually, the outtakes for Getting Closer are better than the released version.
So do you think that's why he wanted to move away from Phil Ramone at that point? Because
that's
it had...
I think everybody was getting comfortable. Isn't that how he put it?
I'm not sure. There were a bunch of people that were let go.
Yeah.
After The Bridge. I think Doug Stegmaier was let go after The Bridge. I think Russell Javers was probably let go after The Bridge.
I couldn't guess why he moved away from Ramone. He certainly didn't do his best work without him.
I remember him saying that he wanted to work with somebody who was a songwriter. That's why he got Mick Jones.
Wasn't Ramone a songwriter in the beginning?
But he didn't write any. I mean, he doesn't have, even in any bios, you never saw like, oh, he co-wrote this or had a minor hit with that.
Yeah, so you hook up with a guy who wrote Hot Blooded? I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know.
You shoot for the moon, Billy.
Yeah, but I remember him saying that, you know, Ramone's strengths were on the technical side, and he wanted somebody who was a songwriter, who was an established songwriter. So that's all that I can all that I can say about that. And if I could go back and start over somehow, I would not change that much, knowing what I know now, though there have been sins I will regret. Still I'm getting closer, getting closer. I don't have all the answers yet, but I'm getting closer, getting closer.
He did amazing things for Billy Joel.
He did amazing things for me. I really think that Phil Ramone's production style kind of defined the way I listened to music as a kid. You know, it really colored the way it colored the stuff that I valued about the way music was recorded. I mean, live drums, live bass, and stuff that sounds clean and tight, but not like David Foster, I guess. I don't know.
Right. That was going to be my punchline. Did you still gravitate towards David
still
Foster?
It was the 80s. You didn't have very many choices. But I really think that the way he did things had a profound impact on the stuff that I looked for in music for a really long time.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think that's one of the reasons why I could never gravitate towards, you know, so much of the AOR and hair metal that came out in the mid-80s and late-80s and beyond, because it sounded like everything was layered and so cold. Whereas, like I said, I grew up listening to Phil Ramone productions where everything just sounded right and warm.
Yeah.
I mean, I was listening today, you know, we were talking about There Goes Rhyming Simon. I was listening to that today, and I was thinking, you know, American Tune, which your favorite song, Paul Simon song. Yeah, that I didn't say that when we first started talking about that, so I want to bring that up again. And I was listening to it, and no matter how much that orchestra swells underneath,
it doesn't overwhelm.
Throughout that, the acoustic guitar is still right there at every second. It never loses sight of that because he knew Paul Simon with his acoustic guitar singing and playing together.
That's the focal point.
Exactly. Yeah. That was the essence of the song. Whatever you put underneath it, it still always boiled down to that Baroque, Bach-inspired guitar part.
I read today that he produced Everything But the Girls version of that song, which I didn't know.
Yes, Tracy Thorne, she tweeted that.
In fact, you're the reason I found out, because of what you put up at Ultimate Classic Rock, yeah.
Yeah, that's how I found out.
And apparently the session lasted 4 hours, because Ben Watt, what did he tweet? Yeah. I learned more from him in 4 hours. Than...
4 hours than he learned in the rest of the time combined. Yeah, and I always think my favorite American Tune is the version from the concert in Central Park, which he produced, because that was Art adding his harmony to it, which was gorgeous.
And I don't know a soul who's not been battered. I don't have a friend who feels at ease. I don't know a dream that's not been shattered or driven to its knees. But it's all right. But I wonder what's going on.
Okay, that's going to do it for this episode of the Pop Does Podcast. Jason, thanks so much for taking some time away from taking pictures of your beautiful baby daughter to return to the fold.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. I would love to do it again. Be fun to get back into doing this a little bit more often.
Well, maybe our thanks are maybe not, we don't thank you that much.
Right. Let's not get crazy.
Right, all right. Sorry, my bad.
Jeff, a pleasure as always.
The pleasure is all mine, gentlemen.
Okay. And thanks most of all to Phil Ramone for the music that he gave us in a career of more than 50 years. Rest in peace, Phil. The Angel's harps will never sound better with you at the board. That was really fucking cheesy.
Well, not only was it cheesy, but you stumbled on your...
I know.
Fixing the delivery.
But we're going in Phil Ramone's spirit and, you know, just like keeping it all alive, though.
Sorry, right.
No overdubs.
Do I have to sit you down at my left elbow and show you how it's done?
My left hand.
Are you going to jerk me off?
All right, guys. Well, let's get together again and do it again soon.
Okay. Visit popdose.com for all the latest in pop culture news, including our March Madness sitcom tournament. Follow us on Twitter at popdose. Download back episodes of our podcast on iTunes. I strongly recommend Jeff's recent interview with David Bearwald.
Thank you.
Just a really fantastic hour discussing his work and the creative process, and I really look forward to the future installments in that series. That got me through waiting at the airport last week.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Yeah, it was so good. And I was never really into Bearwald until I listened to that. So.
Great.
Yeah, we're going to have a second Chart Attack coming soon. Hopefully, there's been a bit of a delay on that, and I was going to finish up today, but I decided to get this done first. But look for that soon. Jason, Jeff, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Not a thing on my end.
I'm good here, too.
That's right. You have no ass.
It's all that biking.
Yeah.
No, I'm out of shape. I gotta get myself back into... I did my first bike thing with the triathlon training yesterday, and I thought I was going to die.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to getting back on the bike because I got on the scale while I was at my mother's place last week, and it was not pretty. You talk about yourself being out of shape, Jason.
Yeah,
nothing compared to me.
And that's pre-peep too.
That's right. Weigh yourself today and weigh yourself tomorrow.
I don't have a scale. There's a reason why I don't have a scale here.
That's, yeah.
After the great Pete massacre of 2013, you should weigh yourself.
Luckily, I don't like Peeps. I do get like a lot of the jelly beans and the malted milk balls and stuff. And I generally don't get the chocolate bunnies because that's usually bad chocolate.
Oh, yeah, that's not even
and
chocolate.
And they're hollow
yeah.
in the middle. You're a man of standards.
Yeah.
When it comes to candy.
Especially if I'm getting it half price.
He wants only the finest candy that Walgreens has to offer.
You know what I was thinking about like creating a new blog in which I review every single thing that Trader Joe's has that is something covered in dark chocolate.
I would rather read reviews of candy from Walgreens. Dave Lifton's discount candyemporium.tumblr.com. Also, it would give you a chance to wear garters on your sleeves because it sounds like the name of an old-timey soda shop.
And I could record myself doing all four parts in a barbershop quartet as long as I've got the arm garters and a candy stripe vest.
And you can hire Gary Hare to work behind the counter. This is all perfect. It's all coming together. I love it.
What the fuck do you want to order?
Of course, if they could remix that album, the concert in Central Park, and take away Richard T's Fender Rhodes piano on everything.
Who doesn't love a Fender Rhodes? What's wrong with you? Philistine.
I love a Fender Rhodes in small doses, not on single fucking song.
What kind of a Super Tramp fan are you?
Mild.
Did they use it? I'm probably fucking this up. I always get the Rhodes and the Wurlitzer mixed up when I make jokes about this stuff. They used a Fender, right?
I think Supertramp was Wurlitzer.
God damn it! See, I did it again.
Wait, I could be. Yeah, it's a Wurlitzer.
Son of a bitch.
But Jason, speaking of Supertramp, I was talking to your mom last night.
You're a bad man.
Oh, I missed you guys.